Well, last week we turned from the New Testament back to the Old Testament, and we met this man called Nehemiah. Now, Nehemiah lived during a time when God's people were scattered throughout the earth. There had been a battle and a destruction of Jerusalem by the Babylonians, and this guy Nehemiah, as our story begins, is living in Susa. Now, Susa happens to be the chief city of the Persian Empire. And we saw that, well, he's an ordinary guy in terms of not having any special pedigree or education, but he's also a passionate follower of the God of Israel. And God has placed Nehemiah in a really strategic position, you'll recall, within Persia. He is cupbearer to the king. That means that he tastes the king's wine before it's given to the king, so that if it's poisoned, which was a common means of death in that time, then the king would not be poisoned. So if this guy is cupbearer, we know that he's also a man of courage and a man who has the trust of the king. So last week, we watched Nehemiah respond to this firsthand account about Jerusalem's ongoing devastation, how the walls of his people's homeland are in ruins and the gates have been burned with fire, and the city of Israel's God is a disgrace in the eyes of the surrounding nations. And you see, it wasn't the walls themselves that really stabbed at Nehemiah's heart, but rather what the walls represented. Because God's glory, established in Jerusalem, was being dragged into the dust. And so Nehemiah, he responds to this news, you'll recall, by weeping. He sits down and he weeps for the once great city where God dwelt with his people. And then Nehemiah prays. You remember? He prays. God plants this vision in his heart of a restored Jerusalem, of rebuilding this wall, and of an opportunity to share his vision with the king. So Nehemiah prays, and he waits, and he prays, and he waits for days, and he prays, and he waits for weeks, and he prays, and he waits for months. He prays that God would move the heart of the king. I like the way this commentator said this. He said, "If I don't believe God can move the heart of a man, then I'm going to be on my feet trying to move man myself. If I believe God can move the heart of a man, then I'm going to be on my knees asking God to do so." Isn't that a great quote? Nehemiah believed that God could move the heart even of a pagan king. And so he understands that also there can never be any revival without confession. So again, we had this wonderful prayer in which he has confessed the sin of his people. He knows, he would have known as a man who was raised in the faith, 2 Chronicles 7:14, which says, "If my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and I will forgive their sin. And I will heal their land." So, with that backdrop in mind, will you please turn with me now to Nehemiah? We're going to read all of chapter 2 together. In the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was brought for him, I took the wine and gave it to the king. I had not been sad in his presence before. So the king asked me, "Why does your face look so sad when you are not ill? This can be nothing but sadness of heart." I was very much afraid, but I said to the king, "May the king live forever. Why should my face not look sad when the city where my fathers are buried lies in ruins and its gates have been completely destroyed by fire?" And then the king said to me, "What is it you want?" Then I prayed to the God of heaven, and I answered the king, "If it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in his sight, let him send me to the city of Judah where my fathers are buried so that I can rebuild it." Then the king, with the queen sitting beside him, asked me, "How long will your journey take, and when will you get back?" It pleased the king to send me, so I set a time. I also said to him, if it pleases the king, may I have letters to the governors of Trans-Euphrates so that they will provide me safe conduct until I arrive in Judah. And may I have a letter to Asaph, keeper of the king's forest, so that he will give me timber to make beams for the gates of the citadel by the temple and for the city wall and for the residence I will occupy. And because the gracious hand of my God was upon me, the king granted my requests. So I went to the governors of Trans-Euphrates and gave them the king's letters. The king had also sent army officers and cavalry with me. When Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official heard about this, they were very much disturbed that someone had come to promote the welfare of the Israelites. I went to Jerusalem, and after staying there 3 days, set out during the night with a few men. I had not told anyone what God had put into my heart to do for Jerusalem. There were no mounts with me except the one I was riding on. By night, I went out through the valley gate toward the jackal well and the dung gate, examining the walls of Jerusalem, which had been destroyed by fire. And then I moved on toward the fountain gate and the king's pool, but there was not enough room for my mount to get through. So I went up the valley by night, examining the gate, examining the wall. Finally, I turned back and re-entered through the valley gate. The officials did not know where I had gone or what I was doing, because as yet I had said nothing to the Jews or the priests or nobles or officials or any others who would be doing the work. Then I said to them, "You see the trouble we're in? Jerusalem lies in ruins, and its gates have been burned with fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem, and we will no longer be in disgrace." I also told them about the gracious hand of my God upon me and what the king had said to me. And they replied, "Let us start rebuilding." So they began this good work. But when Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah the Ammonite official, and Gershom the Arab heard about it, they mocked and ridiculed us. "Huh, what is this you are doing?" they asked. "Are you rebelling against the king?" I answered them by saying, "The God of heaven will give us success. We, his servants, will start rebuilding. But as for you, you have no share in Jerusalem or any claim or historic right to it." This is the word of the Lord, and we give thanks to God for it. So our story starts this morning in the month of Nisan. Sounds like a car. What is that? Why is that there? Basically, we can translate it very easily. This is one day in April. And the important part is, it's 4 months later. We were told the month in chapter 1. We now know the month in chapter 2. It has been 4 months since Nehemiah received this vision from God. And that reminds us that the amount of time that Nehemiah spent in God's waiting room praying was because he was fixed on doing God's work in God's way, in God's timing. And that waiting room piece we talked about last week is one of the hardest pieces, isn't it? But finally, 4 months later, after God has given Nehemiah this vision, he gets the chance to act on it. He's doing his job. He's serving wine to the king. And he tells us, "I had not been sad in the king's presence before." Now remember, this is the guy who had been probably fasting even as he was praying. So if you've spent 4 months fasting and praying, he maybe didn't look quite himself. We really don't know. But he was sad. And the thing is, it's a little bit dangerous when you work for the king to have a sad or negative look on your face, because it could be dangerous. It might suggest that you're involved in some sort of plot. You know, you just have to be careful. And so the king conducts an investigation. He says, "Are you ill?" "No." "Well, then what's wrong with you?" Have you ever noticed that you can often read what's going on inside a person just by sort of looking at their outside? And so the king, he recognizes a broken heart when he sees one. And he says, "You know, this can be nothing but sadness of heart." And then Nehemiah tells us this. Did you notice? He said, "I was very much afraid." I love his honesty. He's not some super saint, you know. He's seeking God in prayer. And that doesn't remove his natural fears. I mean, you can seek God in prayer all you want, but you're still going to have your human feelings. You're still going to be afraid at times. And Nehemiah is afraid. He's about to make a huge request, but he doesn't let his fear stop him from acting. So he responds. He says, "May the king live forever." That's always a good answer, right? That was a sort of traditional sign of respect. Very good start if you're going to be talking with your boss in an important conversation. Giving honor where honor's due. And it doesn't matter that the king is a pagan king in a pagan world. The king is the king. And in a similar way, I might add that the mayor is the mayor and the president is the president, and no matter what we think of their policies, we also have to remember that that position demands respect. One preacher I read this week expressed it, this importance this way. He said, quote, "Some of us in our righteousness are so unrighteous in terms of our behavior that our words cannot be heard," end of quote. So do you want to be heard? Be respectful. Acknowledge the position and the worth of the person to whom you want to speak. May the king live forever. And now Nehemiah has the opportunity he's been praying for. He gets to reveal his passion, his heart. He says, "Why should my face not look sad when the city where my fathers are buried lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire?" And you know, this would have really captured the king's sympathy, because for the Persians, honoring their ancestors was very, very important. So the king asks, "What do you want?" That's a wide open question. What do you want? Isn't that amazing in itself? And then Nehemiah offers this quick prayer. This is actually one of 8 times in the book of Nehemiah when we're going to see him make this quick, spontaneous prayer. This is a man who's developed this intimate relationship with God in private. But even when he's in the middle of a conversation with somebody else, he doesn't hesitate to lift up a prayer. "Hey, this is the time we've been praying for. Here we go, Lord. Here we go, Lord. Please, Lord." So it's really a great example, by the way, if you ever wonder when the Bible talks about pray without ceasing. That's a really good example of it. Just constant mindset of being in conversation with God. So after he prays, Nehemiah asks the king, well, basically for a sabbatical. He asks for permission to go to Judah. And the king says, yes. The king says, yes. That's amazing. There you go. And then we see that Nehemiah has obviously been thinking and planning during his months of praying and waiting. Because, you know, spirituality doesn't necessarily imply impracticality. Nehemiah is very practical. So first he needs a passport, right? So he asks for letters of safe conduct. And then, well, he needs a gift card to Home Depot. So he asks for a letter to Asaph to get lumber. He needs hotel accommodations in Jerusalem. So he asks for enough lumber to build a house for himself, too. And just in case there's any doubt about the fact that God has been orchestrating all of this, notice that the king throws in a bonus, a limousine, and an escort of army officers and cavalry. That wasn't even something that was asked for. And what's Nehemiah's explanation for all of this? In verse 8, he sums it up, "Because God's gracious hand was upon me." God did it. He knows God did it. He gives God all the glory and all the credit. And so, finally, Nehemiah travels to Judah. He gets to go. And I think it's worth noting that when he finally arrives, he doesn't immediately get down to business. He recognizes that rest is a really necessary part of useful action. And so, did you notice that he rests for 3 days? And if you were to look back at Ezra, the book before this, Ezra 8:15, would see that Ezra did the same thing when he arrived. He camped there for 3 days after his arrival before taking any action. So, Nehemiah arrives in Jerusalem, and he rests. When he finally does begin to move, he does so in secret. He says, "I had not told anyone what God had put in my heart to do for Jerusalem." See, he knows he's there on God's errand, and he knows that he must communicate to God's people that his motive is God-given rather than some self-made idea that he came up with. But he also knows that he'll need to translate his vision to the people in very practical ways. So Nehemiah begins by quietly assessing the situation. And there's wisdom in that, because, you know, in the early phases of a new idea, it's just really easy for people to draw incorrect conclusions. Can't you hear people saying when Nehemiah comes by, "Well, here comes that empire builder. Look at him." If a person has a powerful passion from God compelling them to do something, they can be misunderstood. And so Nehemiah, he does this reconnaissance quietly at night, And he doesn't play the politician and build like a lot of hype about how he's going to restore Jerusalem to its glory days. He gathers data. He assesses the reality of the situation calmly and without any input from the crowds. He recognizes the need to assess the project's feasibility and also to prevent enemies or traitors from jumping on the strategy before it even gets off the ground, before he's even presented it. So he makes sure he understands exactly what needs to be done before sharing his vision with the people. And only then does Nehemiah say in verse 17, "Hey, do you see the trouble we're in? Do you see the trouble we're in?" Why does he say that? Well, because there's a really good chance that they didn't see it. You know, if you live in a mess or in chaos, you tend not to notice it after a while. It becomes your norm. Don't ask me how I know that, but if you live in a mess, it becomes your norm, and it's not till you're going to invite company in or your landlord needs to come up for a repair that you look at it with new eyes and say, "Oh, I'd better tidy up a bit here." So he says, "Look at this. We have a problem here." And you know, it's easy to imagine that even with the walls broken down, the Israelites had gotten used to that. You know, yeah, the wall's broken, but I kind of like the shape of it, and I think that grass growing through is a little bit attractive. And, you know, he needed to give them a new perspective to say, open your eyes, look around you. God's glory, his name is being dragged through the dust. Look at the rubble, look at the mess. We've got a problem here. They've gotten used to their disgrace, and it feels normal to them. So Nehemiah needed to say something to overcome their apathy. And when we come before people who are tired or disgruntled, when we come back with this new vision and we're confronted with people who say things like, "Oh, that's so out of our league," or, "I don't know where you think you're getting all these big ideas," or, "Who do you think you are?" Or they look back on Ezra's time and trying to do some rebuilding and say, "Hey, we tried that before and it was a disaster." The only thing that will keep you going in a situation like that is the certainty that God planted this vision in your heart. So watch how Nehemiah responds. He says, "I told them about the gracious hand of my God upon me and what the king had done and said to me." Again, he responds with information, not with cheerleaders, not with slogans, not with hype. He tells them what God has done. He illustrates the sense of God's hand being upon this entire project by giving this description, which is from the first part of the chapter. Remember, he says, you know, he tells the story. Can't you hear him telling this story? He, "You know, I went into my boss on this particular day, like every other day, and when he asked me why I looked sad, I told him about Jerusalem." "Wow, you said that to the guy?" Yeah, I told him. I told him. "Well, what did he say?" Well, he said, "What do you want?" "No way. He said that? Wow, that's amazing." I mean, can't you? He's telling them blow by blow what God did, because it is amazing, isn't it? So Nehemiah shows them that God's behind this, that something remarkable has happened, and the only way it could have happened was by God's divine enabling. And here's their reply now. "Let us then start building." When a vision is God-given and humbly presented, as Nehemiah did it, suddenly our existence here makes sense, doesn't it? It isn't about the walls. It's about God's glory. It isn't about the parlor or the carpeting. It's about God's glory. I can say that because we don't have a parlor here. Parlors are very important in a lot of churches. You know, because we often get really preoccupied with a lot of the trivia and what's happening here and now and the earthly and the transient things, and we lose sight of things that are really eternal in their significance. It's easy to think about them right here in church, right? But when you get out in the week and real life happens, right? Eternal significance. That's what Nehemiah has put this in a framework so that they can see it. At the height of World War II, I want to share this with you, Winston Churchill, he transformed the morale of a very battered and bombed Great Britain when he cast his vision for his new government in terms of its eternal significance. I think this is just an awesome model that Nehemiah would have been proud of. I want to share with you a bit of his speech to put things in perspective. Here's what Winston Churchill said. He famously said, "I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat. We have before us an ordeal of the most grievous kind. We have before us many, many months of struggle and suffering. You ask, what is our policy? I say it is to wage war by land, sea, and air, war with all our might and with all the strength God has given us, and to wage war against a monstrous tyranny never surpassed in the dark and lamentable catalog of human crime. That is our policy. You ask, what is our aim? I can answer in one word. It is victory. Victory at all costs. Victory in spite of all terrors. Victory, however long and hard the road may be, for without victory there is no survival. I take up my task in buoyancy and hope. I feel sure that our cause will not be suffered to fail among men. I feel entitled at this juncture, at this time, to claim the aid of all and to say, come then, let us go forward together in our united strength." That was a man after Nehemiah's heart. He took the situation and he framed it in terms of the eternal, in terms of the significance of what was going on. And this battered and bloody London began to stir and rose and responded to the call. But, of course, opposition comes, right? You saw that. We got to that part. We're going to get to it more next week on how to deal with the opposition. But I promise you, whenever you're engaged in a God-given task or mission, if you're doing anything that's of value to God's kingdom, you will face opposition. It will happen. It just will. It's inevitable. So, here we meet three of the key players, Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem. And these guys are governors in the region. Around, and they're under the authority of Persia, but they sort of have moved into the Jerusalem, the Judah area, and they have, it's a practical matter, the real power there now. So they're not thrilled to see Nehemiah come. They're the hecklers, and they say, "Hey, are you rebelling against the king?" Now, again, watch what Nehemiah does. He's very consistent. Remember, he has all these letters in his pocket, right? He could have just reached into his pocket and pulled out and, you know, said, "Oh, do you mean King Artaxerxes, the guy whose seal is on all these letters, the guy who's paying for this project and provided all the materials?" Because, you know, I don't know, I would be really tempted to do that, to gloat and say, "Yeah, as a matter of fact, I do have the king's permission to be here." But he doesn't. What does he say? Look how he responds. He's being ridiculed. He says, "The God of heaven will give us success." That's his answer. He has God's approval, and that's enough. And he adds, "And by the way, you can go home now." That's how our passage ends. You know, get lost. This is our holy city here. You don't have any claim on it. You have no right to it. But mark my words, our God will give us success, and we'll go on. There's a wonderful quote from the great missionary Hudson Taylor. Hudson Taylor put it this way. He said, "God's work done in God's way will never lack supply." I once heard a very remarkable Presbyterian pastor and preacher ask his congregation this bold question. Here's what he said. He said, "What are we trusting God to do that is so incredible that it cannot be achieved apart from his divine enabling? That's so incredible that should it happen, people will say, surely God is in this place." I think that's a great question. What are we trusting God to do that's so incredible that it cannot be achieved apart from God's divine enabling? Do we really believe that in a time like this, in a place like this, in the Granite State, in this moment in history, that God could light a flame that wouldn't be extinguished, that God could do something God-sized even through us at this moment? What are we trusting God to do that can only be achieved as a result of God's enabling? Because, you know, the real miracle in this story, for me anyway, the miracle in Nehemiah's story, it's not that Nehemiah would go 800 miles to this task of rebuilding. The miracle is that God would use Nehemiah for this task of rebuilding. The miracle is not that we give ourselves to God's service. The miracle is that God would use us. This is a God. He creates from nothing, right? He doesn't need anything, but he chooses to use us. What an amazing mystery. What an amazing privilege. And so I want you to think this week, Windham Presbyterian Church, what pricks your heart Is our God's name being dragged through the dust? If you look at the media, I would suggest maybe it is. What would God have us do about it? Can I ask you this week to think about that and pray about that? I mean, really, to put aside time. I know it's hard. And think about that and pray about that. Because God's still doing miracles like this. We could step up and the king could give us a Home Depot gift card and a passport and do something amazing. God does it all the time. But are we looking for it, and are we looking to do God's thing in God's way and God's timing? There's such a thrilling opportunity, and I can't wait to see what it's going to be, but please ask yourself that this week. What pricks your heart? What might God be calling us to do that can only be done in his power? Pray that this week, and would you pray with me right now, please? Father God, forgive us when we think of you in such puny terms sometimes. We get so wrapped up in the parlor and the carpet and in what we're going to have for dinner and all just the not unimportant but transient types of things that just get in the way and sometimes can cloud our vision, and we can live in a mess and live in chaos and not even realize it. Lord, give us eyes to see the state of your name, of your glory, of what you would be doing in this country in this year of 2017. United States of America, New Hampshire, Windham, Derry, Londonderry, all the communities around here, Salem. We so would be honored and privileged to be a part of that. I pray that you would call us to prayer this week with such a strong, persistent voice that we could not ignore it, that we would each find ourselves this week in deep prayer and seeking what you are doing here. That we would be Nehemiahs in our praying, in our waiting, and then when the moment arrives to act, in our boldness and asking for what we need, and in our persistence, even in the face of opposition, to the very end, for your glory. Amen. Would you please rise and join in singing?